say your name for me, please?
Yes, my name is Larry Gordon Himes.
Can you say that again?
Sure. My name is Larry Gordon Himes.
Okay. Okay, there we go. All right. So why don't you start at the beginning for me?
Okay. I grew up, my dad's retired Air Force, so I grew up as a military dependent, never had any plans of going in the military. I had started college back in 1970, would have been September of 78 after I graduated high school. I was able to start a year into college, so I started as a sophomore, ended up dropping out of school and moving out to Montana because I knew my dad was going to retire out here. He had bought some property. So I came out, met the gal that was going to end up being my wife, and was working in the sawmill, and I figured out I wasn't making enough money to be married and have a family. So I kind of panicked. I went up to Kalispell. I was living up in the Swan Valley at the time here in Montana. Went to Kalispell and talked to a recruiter for the Air Force. The Air Force didn't need anybody. He says, go talk to the Army or the Navy. And I said, I don't want to be in the Army or the Navy. So he was a little upset with me. He's like, oh, I've already made mission. So I had my ASVAB scores from earlier, and I'd done really well. So he got a little excited after that. Says,
well, that was,
no problem. You need to get it?
No.
Your alarm?
It's someone else for another interview.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
That's right. Anyway, went ahead and retook the ASVAB, and I couldn't go in for like 5 months. So I think I talked to him in May. Toward the end of the summer, my wife, now my fiance, we decided to go ahead and get married in November. So I had to go up and redo the paperwork right toward the end of August because now I'd be enlisting as a married individual. So we got married in November. I left for basic training the end of December. Unfortunately, we got down there like 2 days before New Year's, so we get to the basic training base at Lackland Air Force Base. There's nobody there, so we had a couple of guys who were there to learn to be drill instructors. They're marching us around, taking us to chow, and so we spent about an extra week in training, went through all that. I ended up, when I enlisted, they gave me a bunch of tests in Butte at the MEPS here in Montana. And it was kind of ironic. I'd been an English major in college because I was kind of lazy, didn't want to take foreign languages. Well, when they gave me all my aptitude tests, they said, well, we want you to enlist as a Russian linguist. So that's what I went in to be. Well, at the time, I went through school for the Defense Language Institute. They were revamping all the student housing out in California. So I ended up going through my training at Lackland Air Force Base. So I spent almost a year and a half down there. By the time I get done with basic training, and they used to have a pre-course for grammar, which is a really good course. And then we spent 47 weeks going through the Russian training. Once I completed that, our first daughter was born, so we had to be on administrative hold for a few weeks because my wife couldn't travel. So then I went to San Angelo, and we spent 6 months there. I had to learn equipment training because I was going to be an airborne linguist. Not like the Army where you're airborne and you jump with parachutes. We were just going to fly around in the back of a large aircraft and collect radio waves being transmitted. And when we first went in, we all thought, oh, yeah, we'll be flying over Russia. No, we didn't do any of that. We were always in international waters. But it was interesting work. We had to go through survival training. And the thing is, when I enlisted for 4 years. And since the Air Force was never under a lot of pressure to get a lot of people, they were pretty upfront with you about everything. And the guy called me at one point and said, look, they want me to enlist you for 6 years, but if you only enlist for four, like you are now, and you like it, you can re-enlist for four more and you get a really big bonus. He says, if you enlist for six right now, you'll only get like $1,200. And I said, oh, yeah, I'll just go for four. Well, by the time I got done with all of my training with language, equipment, radio theory, all this other stuff, survival, I'd been in the Air Force for 25 months already. So I had to extend for 13 months just to take my family to Okinawa with me. So I ended up for 5 years and a month on my first enlistment. Decided I didn't like it after I'd done my first tour of duty. My wife wanted to move back to Montana. So we got out and came back here. I actually ended up working back in the sawmill again in Sealy Lake. We lived in Condon near her mom. And I, of course, when I'd been in the Air Force, that was from 1981 through basically May of 86. So that was at the height of kind of like the end of the Cold War. And the most interesting thing that happened for us in our unit there in Okinawa, they had the shoot down of the Korean airliner that had taken off out of Fairbanks, Alaska, and they put an erroneous data stream in their autopilot, and they ended up flying 2 degrees too far to the west. They ended up overflying some of the Soviet airspace and eventually got shot down right off of Sakhalin Island. Well, that was kind of the area where we covered their traffic. So that was a big deal, and that was just before I got out. And, of course, that was a huge international thing. Other than that, it was pretty routine. It was interesting work. But, unfortunately, I primarily copied Soviet air traffic, and they didn't talk very much. So my Russian really suffered. So I got out, didn't really have a marketable skill, so went back to work at the sawmill for a couple of years. By 1990, we weren't making enough money up in the Condon area in the Swan Valley, so I decided to look for work over near Seattle. So I ended up getting a job at Lindahl Cedar Homes, and while I was there looking for work, I had talked to a National Guard recruiter with the Army, and I kept seeing these advertisements in the paper, wanted Russian linguists in the Army National Guard, and I thought, why would they have a Russian linguist unit? So I had talked to them, figured out that I didn't have the paperwork to enlist at that time, so that was probably March of 90. Went and got my wife and kids. We moved them over in June of 1990, signed a year-long lease. Well, as we were living there for a few months, I realized I needed more money. So I went and talked to that recruiter again. Now I had all my paperwork. So I enlisted January of 91 as a actually to go to officer training, but I could get in as a Russian linguist because I'd already had the training. So I did that. We stayed there till about June, and that was when our lease was due to be renewed. My wife didn't like it there. It was really expensive. We weren't making quite enough money. So we moved back to Montana. Well, I didn't do the officer training thing, and I didn't have a Russian linguist unit here in Montana. The way the Guard works, you just go to the local unit, and whatever their unit type is, that's the training you receive. So I went to drill in Kalispell, and so I had to become a tank crewman. And that was really fun. I liked being in tanks. They're a lot of fun. I did pretty good, did really good with all the training. And they wanted to send me to a school for tankers that's called Master Gunner Training. But I was only like an E4. I did get my E5, but you couldn't even go to the school unless you were an E7. So I knew I wasn't going to be able to do any of that. And we had trouble keeping enough guys in the unit to keep our crews filled up. Well, then I heard about a new unit. They were starting in Missoula in 1995. It was a mechanized infantry unit, and they used Bradley fighting vehicles. They're not a tank, but some people think they look like a tank. But they're a little less armored and have a smaller weapon, but they carry dismounted guys in the back. And that intrigued me. I knew there'd be better promotion opportunities. So I transferred down to this unit here in Missoula, started drilling with them in April of 95. Got through the training, and I did pretty good. I'd been a good gunner in the tanks, and I did really good in the Bradleys. Well, by 1997, our commander at the time, he knew I'd been through some pretty tough schools with the Air Force, so he called me into his office one day. He says, how hard was that training in the Defense Language Institute? And I said, oh, we'd lose about 50% of our folks. And they had a master gunner course for the Bradley fighting vehicle, but you only had to be an E6 to go to that school. And I was actually, I had just been promoted to E6, and I was really good with training. And I'd already been a tank crew evaluator, and I was a Bradley evaluator. So he says, well, if you go to this school and you pass, you've got a good chance to get a full-time job here with the unit. And my wife, I had my own business at the time doing drafting for log homes and other things. So she was pretty excited because she knew I had no retirement set up or anything like that. And money was always kind of up and down every month. So she was pretty excited. She's like, when do you get out of here? So I had to close my business. I went down to Fort Benning for 3 months, got through the course. And once I came back, I applied for one of the jobs here in the state, and I ended up getting the job in Missoula, which really surprised me because there had been a couple other guys who outranked me that I thought would come here, and it just worked out. We were able to get the job in Missoula. So we moved to Stevensville in 1998, and I had started my job in October of 97. Well, I stayed in that position till about 1999. I think of May of 99, I had to move down to Hamilton. The guy who was my supervisor wanted me to get experience as what they call a unit readiness NCO, and you're responsible for promotions, travel, all the things that would be done administratively in a guard unit so that the unit's ready to go. Before, I had just been responsible for training individual soldiers, scheduling them for schools and everything, and I also ran the ranges for the Bradleys and set up training within the unit. Well, now I went down to Hamilton, which was just a platoon down there. Unfortunately, it was a very small platoon, and we didn't even really get to drill much in Hamilton. Because we were so close to Missoula, we would just always drive up to Missoula and do our training. So my supervisor was frustrated. I wasn't getting the experience he wanted me to get, and frankly, it was pretty boring down there in Hamilton. So then I always joke that I kind of went nuts, and I heard about openings they had for recruiters. And again, promotions were really good to get into recruiting. So I applied for a recruiting position, and I started in September of 2001. That was on the 1st, and of course, you know, 11 days later, 9/11 happened, so that was kind of a big deal. So my first year as a recruiter for the Montana Army National Guard, I was working out of the armory here in Missoula again at that time, and we had a lot of prior service people come in, and it was pretty easy recruiting that first year. Well, I get into the second year, and I still made my mission. I think at the time we had to get 24 people a year, which sounds easy, but Montana has so few people, it's really tough to make the numbers that they expect someone in a metropolitan area to make or something. And, of course, as you go through the training, and the Guard sent me to a school down in the National Guard does all their professional-level training at North Little Rock, Arkansas, at a place called Camp I can't think of the name now, Anyway, all the professional courses are there for full-time people, some other stuff for even part-time guys if you're running small arms ranges. So I went through the course, and that was about 2 months long. So I get back, and our instructors had told us, you're going to have a hard time out west making these kind of numbers, and you need to figure out what works. Well, unfortunately, our leadership in Helena, some of those people go through the course, but all they hear is the book learning. They don't actually do the job, and then they're trying to tell you how to do your job, and they don't really know what they're doing. So I stayed in recruiting for about 3.5 years, but there was a lot of pressure, really long days, and I did eventually get promoted to E7, which was kind of my career goal, and I held that for about 19 months, and by the 3.5 years into recruiting, I was getting kind of tired of the stress, and my wife was getting tired of me never being home. I was gone usually from 8 in the morning till about 10 at night, and I finally took the option. They kind of hinted at one of the meetings for the recruiters that if you weren't making mission, they would try to find you a different job. So I took a demotion back to E6 and was reassigned back down to Hamilton at the armory there. Well, while this is all going on, the original unit I had started with that was an infantry unit, they had been deployed to Iraq. So I used to joke, yeah, you know you love your job when you take about $1,100 a month pay cut and you'd rather go to a war zone for 6 months. So I was individually mobilized for a guy who had been shot. He was actually my son's squad leader because my son was in the Guard at the time. So I go through my training down at Fort Carson, and I ended up getting into Iraq about June of 2005. I had told him I wanted a new job back. My last day in recruiting was 1st of April, April Fool's Day, 2005. So I ended up going through the training. I took some leave also, and I ended up in Iraq about June of 2005. Well, by the time I got there, and I knew this would happen, they had cross-leveled within the unit. So the E6 I was there to replace, they'd already moved somebody into his position. He'd been medevaced back to the U.S., and so they put me in a position as the sergeant of the guard. We were in a really tiny FOB called FOB McHenry over in Iraq, and we were kind of out in the country. We were north and a little west of Baghdad quite a ways, but we were south and a little bit west of Kirkuk. So we're kind of out in the country, not much around us. And they put me in a position as sergeant of the guard. So my duties were to, with two other guys, we worked 3 8-hour shifts, so we covered it 24 hours a day. And our job was to go out and greet the shift change, brief any of the incoming guards on any new intel from the headquarters. And then during our 8-hour shift, we'd go around at least once an hour to all the towers around the FOB. And the FOB is a forward operating base. And we'd go around and make sure that they were complying with safety regulations, keeping their helmets on. We'd check to see if they needed, you know, cold beverages if it was hot, or if they wanted coffee if it was cold at night, things like that. Make sure they're awake and just see if they have any needs. We'd also check generators and stuff. And it was sounds like it would be a boring job. And I was kind of disappointed. I really wanted to go over there and be able to go out, what we called going out of the wire, going off the FOB to go do missions. And, of course, I couldn't do that because of my assignment. I kind of worked right for headquarters. So I was able to get out about 6 different times. I would know when a convoy was coming up, and I would know if they had an open seat. So I'd contact the NCO in charge of the convoy. And sometimes it would be an officer, and I'd say, hey, can I get a seat in one of your vehicles? So I got out about 6 times in the 6 months, and sometimes it was with training teams, and sometimes it was with line units. And Iraq was nothing like you thought it would be. I mean, we were all trained for combat, and we were all trained for Bradleys, but we didn't really use the Bradleys. There really wasn't any combat. You just were kind of a rolling target. So it was kind of stressful for some of the guys. For my job, what was interesting was they had 2 different gates to get into the FOB. They had one that was a military gate, and that's where our vehicles would go in and out because we knew we could trust them. They wouldn't be suicide vehicles or anything like that. Then we had a separate gate for civilians, and we didn't really allow civilian vehicles on the FOB, but we could take foot traffic, and they would have health and welfare checks available for people. We also had people who would check in with local disputes, and our commander on the FOB would try to assist with a little bit with, like, local disputes and local politics, because unfortunately most people here don't understand most of the world runs on tribal or clan affiliations in the Middle East anyway. And so if people were from a different clan and the mayor was from another clan, they might not be getting the money they wanted. So they'd come in and want to meet with our commanders and have big meetings and have him help settle disputes or whatever. So we would that gate was open every day except Wednesday, and Friday is the holy day for Muslims. So that's when they go to mosque and do all their stuff. So the 2 days of the week that that gate wasn't open, we would have a lot of local guys who might want to either provide information to our intelligence people, and they had a monetary motive. I mean, they could get paid if they gave us good intel and stuff. So they were kind of like agents from the local community that would come in and want to talk to our people. Well, of course, the 2 days they want to come in are Wednesday and Friday when nobody else is around. So I would always get calls from my guys on that tower and say, hey, we got some guy out here. So I didn't have an interpreter assigned. So I had made friends with a lot of our local interpreters that worked with us so that I could go and kind of just pick one of them up and say, hey, I'm sorry, can you come down to the gate and help me? I know you're not working right now. And they were really good about helping me out. So I had made some pretty good friends with our interpreters who were mostly from up north. And so we'd have to go down, and I'd have to meet a guy at the gate. And I didn't really want my interpreter to see him because I didn't know if I could trust him either, even though he's from far away. So I would have to have them talk to the guy and keep them separated and then put the guy in a room isolated and then get a guard on him and then go try to call the headquarters on the radio. And if that wasn't working, I had to send a runner. And so it was pretty interesting. The most weird thing we had, one day I got a call from one of my tower guard crews, and they're like, hey, we've got a donkey coming down the military lane, which by then we'd had these big concrete barriers set up in kind of what we call a snake pattern. And this donkey had wandered in, and he had bags, like fabric saddle bags, and you could tell there was something in them. Well, they had set off what we used to joke about, a donkey bomb up the road about a half mile and blown up some local trucks one time. So they wouldn't just use vehicles and human suicide bombers. They would use donkeys or anything else. So it's my responsibility to get this thing out of there. And some of the guys are joking, like, well, just shoot it. And I'm like, no, because if he's got a bomb, now how are we going to get out of here? And someone else is like, well, just catch him and ride him out. Sarge, you're from Montana. I'm like, no, because if he's got a bomb, I'm going to blow up. So I remember I had to kind of try to herd him with my Humvee, and we finally got him back out of this really tortuous path through the lane to the highway. And turned out it belonged to some local kids, and he'd gotten away in the morning, and he ran over to them, and my other tower guys reported it. But that was probably the funniest thing we had happen over there, kind of odd. But you just never knew what was going to happen. After that tour of duty, I came back to the States. We got back in October of 05, and I started up my duties in Hamilton again. Well, in the meantime, the state of Montana will do this. Other states will do it. We reorganized. So now suddenly the infantry platoon in Hamilton is going to move to Kalispell. And they already had a guy up there that was going to take over that part of the unit. So they converted my unit into an engineering platoon. So now I'm picking up brand new kids who have just enlisted in the Guard, a few people who had cross-trained over. So I met some people I knew from before, but all the infantry guys basically went away. And we stood up a brand new unit in Hamilton beginning in September of 05, which is the beginning of the fiscal year, is right at the beginning of October. So I think our first drill was the end of September, and then we started trying to drill. Well, we had no guidance on how to set up the unit, so that was a little stressful for a while. And we were actually assigned to a company out of Nebraska, which that created other issues. And later, we ended up transferring to a company out of Hawaii. And eventually, we did deploy to Afghanistan. We left in January of 2010. We had to report on like the 7th, which is a Friday. We got all the gear loaded up, inventoried our personal gear, made sure everyone was there. And I think we flew out on the 10th, which was like a Saturday. And so I don't know what 7th was, like a Wednesday or Thursday. When we get to Afghanistan, we were on a very large base over there. And our job was to build buildings on the base or any facilities that we could handle. And we were what we call vertical engineers, so we didn't have bulldozers or any heavy equipment. We did have a backhoe, which we didn't take. We did take a Bobcat over there because we could fit that in one of the Connexes. And all that was for was to do some prep work on the ground if we were going to lay foundations. Or everything over there was built on blocks and piers. We didn't have to dig trenches and pour footings or any of that kind of stuff because nothing we built was supposed to be permanent. So we picked up work on the base, and we did a lot of that. A lot of the kids in our unit had no background in building at all. Most people who come in the Guard come in to get education benefits, so that was our big selling point back when I was in recruiting. So a lot of people could get everything paid for or even get student loans repaid. So I had a bunch of younger people in my squad, and I was still an E6. I couldn't get promoted any higher because since we were only a platoon, the platoon sergeant, who's an E7, has to be a part-time person. And then I could only fill one of the E6 positions as the full-timer. Well, for me, it was kind of a vacation, oddly enough, going over there because I didn't have to do all the paperwork and all the supply work and all the responsibilities I have as a full-timer. So all I had to do was push my squad and do our projects. And that was actually a good assignment. Some of our younger soldiers were a little gung-ho like I had been when I went to Iraq, and you figure out, oh, this isn't very exciting and it's not very dangerous other than accidents and occasional mortars or something. So some of them were frustrated, and we'd talk about why we were there and were we making a difference. And I think it was a good experience for most of them who had never had a chance to be out of the country. For me, growing up, it was good. I'd lived in Turkey with my dad and when he was assigned over there and our family. I'd lived in Germany when I was really little. So a lot of these kids, they go over there. And a typical conversation is like, well, Sergeant Himes, what about these Taliban guys? Why do they hate us? I said, well, you know, most of these guys working for the Taliban just need to make like $50 American. That's a bride price in Afghanistan to go get married. And they can get that kind of money either working for a drug trader or a Taliban leader. He goes, oh, so they're kind of like us. I'm just in the Guard to get money to go to college. And I'd say, exactly. You know, everyone's got their motivations, and it's not always ideological. So, you know, we didn't hate them, and a lot of them didn't hate us. But, and it's interesting to see how people live differently. And Some of our guys would, you know, they'd make fun of, well, why don't they wash more? And I'd say, well, look, what kind of water supply do they have? And Afghanistan's a very, it's a high altitude country and it's very dry. So I said, you know, we can take it for granted that we can take a shower every day. And even on the FOB we were on, we had pretty good living conditions. We were living in tents, but they were permanently set up tents. And some of the guys actually lived in a wooden barracks type building that we ended up helping to build. So it was a good experience for our soldiers to see how well we live compared to the rest of the world and understand some of the things people are up against. Now that I came back, we got back right at the end of the year. My wife picked me up New Year's Eve, December 31st, 2010. We had been over at Fort Lewis. It's now Joint Base Lewis-McChord in near Seattle-Tacoma area. And we missed Christmas here at home, but it was worth it because we knew we were going to get home before New Year's. So we did all of our out processing there for about 2 weeks, and my wife picked me up in Missoula at the airport like 11:45 at night on the 31st of December. So I was able to retire the end of January of 2012, and then I started here at the university full time. But so I did – my 20 years was kind of broken up between the Air Force, and then I was able to get on full-time with the Guard, and my part-time eventually will count toward my retirement when I hit 60. But overall, I'd say the military was a good experience for me. I kind of knew what I was getting into because my dad had been military. It was a big shock going from full-time to part-time, and then we ran into a lot of issues – often when we would have full-time Army advisors come help us with our training, like if I was running a range or doing annual training with our unit, they're used to doing it every day of the week, and most of our guys do it 1 weekend a month. And so we had to get things done in a really condensed amount of time, and we never cut corners, but we would do things differently than they would. And usually they'd come in thinking, well, we're going to show you guys how to do it. And half the time they'd leave scratching their heads like, well, how do you guys get all this done? So there's a lot of cultural conflict between the active side and the Guard and Reserve side just because there's a different dynamic. And a lot of our guys who might only be an E4 in the Guard, they might be a supervisor in their civilian job. So they're the equivalent of an E7 or an E8 in the Army. So it was kind of funny if you could get through the friction. But if you went on a deployment and you're trying to deal with active duty people and somebody who's an E6 or an E7 would come up to an E4 and he'd say, hey, go take this and go over and do that. And he'd say, yeah, but Sarge, we could do it this way. And they'd get really irritated because in the Army they're not used to being talked back to. And they might get a little upset with our guys. And I'd say, you know what, this kid's like 3 years into a degree program and he's a supervisor at his job in the civilian world. And just because he's wearing an E4 rank, he's not a dummy and he doesn't mean to be disrespectful, so we'd have to run a lot of interference to keep bad blood from getting between our guys and the full-time guys. But, yeah, overall, it was a good – I think it was an interesting career, and I get to do quite a bit of different stuff. So I don't think I have any problems from my deployments or anything. So,
I mean, so it sounds like you had a pretty positive experience in the military.
I did, yeah.
So, I mean, compared to a lot of veterans I've talked to that have been – through some real tough times and stuff like that. I mean, when you were in Iraq and Afghanistan, it sounded like you had a little more of a positive time than some people, especially veterans at this school I've talked to. I mean, have you ever seen anything that...
Well, I think the worst thing I saw, we had one night, we had a medevac call from the local town. And I mentioned earlier they had tribal rivalries and clan rivalries. And our big issue in the area would be, you know, we'd be sitting there about 1 o'clock in the morning on a midnight to 8 o'clock shift, and you'd hear gunfire off to the west, and we'd know, okay, we don't have any patrols in that area, so the guy in the tactical operations center, the TOC, he might call up and say, hey, in the Iraqi Army, he'd call IA compound, and I can't remember what their call sign was, but he'd say, you know, hey, we hear gunshots fired. Do you have any problems? Do you need any assistance? And they'd say, oh, no, it's we'll talk to you in a minute. So they would go, and whether they were trying to make up a story or figure out what was going on, and they might call back a little later and say, oh, it's a celebratory gunfire. They're having a wedding. And we're like, yeah, it's 1 o'clock in the morning. Nobody's having a wedding. Well, then about half an hour later, we get a phone call or we get a radio call, and they're like, we need to request medevac. We have a wounded policeman. Well, the policemen were all from one tribe, and the Army guys are from another tribe. And sometimes they would get in fights with each other. And these were our allies, which was kind of not very encouraging. So one night they brought in a guy, and he was on a stretcher, and I think he'd been shot through one lung, and his legs were shot up pretty good. And I think the other guy just had an arm wound or something. So, I mean, there was stuff that went on, but I don't know. I guess with my upbringing and maybe because I'd had a lot of experience with different stuff, it didn't get to me as bad as it might other people. Same with, you know, my wife and I have talked about since, you know, our marriage relationship, and it's just something that you know that you're going to get separated. And unfortunately, some people say, well, the military is so hard on marriages. But I know good and well, I've known guys years ago from Montana who would go work on the pipeline or work up in Alaska seasonally. And when those guys come back from a long time of separation, they're going to have the same types of issues, because in 3 or 4 months, you've changed and your wife has changed and your kids have changed. And so it's just kind of – it's just part of the territory. And having grown up with my dad being in the military, we just kind of – we didn't have unrealistic expectations about that. I think one of the worst things for some of our soldiers was coming back from a deployment. Since Montana is not a very high-wage area, a lot of our guys, even the older guys, would have trouble with money because they got used to a relatively high paycheck compared to most wages in Montana. And they might have, you know, purchased a vehicle while they were deployed, and now they get back and they can't make payments. And that was probably one of the biggest sources of stress. So we – the Army does try to do a really good job, and particularly the Guard, encouraging young soldiers, don't get married to somebody you barely know just to make more money, which that was another problem we could have, and don't make emotional decisions and big purchases while you're deployed, because when you come back, our own son went through that. He bought a car he really couldn't afford and wouldn't listen to advice from us, and ended up losing the car and getting into some debt. And he ended up going back in the Army active duty because he could get a bonus and pay off his debts. So sometimes it just depends on the individual and what their background is and how they handle stress. So
what's it been like being in the military with you and your son at the same time?
You know, at first I was kind of surprised they would send us over there. I was kind of thinking, wow, does this violate some sort of rules? And what they would have done if I had been in a position to be, you know, frontline leader of guys going out on missions, they would have made sure that I didn't have him in my particular squad. I did get to go out one time with his lieutenant and their platoon. And, you know, when I was over there, we would visit every once in a while, but it's – you're just kind of busy with your own little piece of the mission. So with me, I had a weird sleep schedule because I might be on, you know, midnight to 8, or we would rotate, I think, once every month. And then if somebody went on leave, then I would work, you know, midnight to noon, and the other guy would come in at noon and work till midnight. And so we might have 12-hour days or rotating 8-hour shifts. And, of course, his schedule would be whatever the mission requirements were. So even though we could see each other, we didn't see each other that often. And I don't know. You know, some people were – when I was in recruiting, I would have parents who would be upset. They'd say, well, I don't want you talking to my son or my daughter because I don't want them going to Iraq. And I'd say, well, my son's over there. And I think this kind of goes back to the idea of stress. Statistically, you're more in danger in this country driving in a vehicle than you are going to a war – you know, fewer guys were dying in war or conflict in the war over there than – people die every day in this country in cars. But we accept that risk because it's part of our culture and we're used to it. And so a lot of times perception can make a big difference on how people view things. And it's unfortunate that I think in general, yeah, the military has a negative – kind of a negative reputation, and I don't know that it's always warranted. I think it's just how do people deal with things and how do you adapt to that. So.
And how do you deal with people that are negative about the military?
You know, it's my dad was in the military. My sister ended up going in the Air Force. I have 4 children. Only one of them hasn't been in the military. It's almost like it's just something that if you're familiar with it, you think of it as an option, or it's just something that you don't you're not afraid of it. And it's interesting. It's not even just negative things. Sometimes, like when I used to tell people, "Yeah, I used to be an airborne linguist," and they say, "Oh, what kind of plane did you?" Or I just say, "I was in the Air Force." Well, what kind of plane did you fly? Well, only officers fly the planes, and then enlisted guys take care of the planes. And so, I think a lot of it's just a lack of education on the part of the general public, and it's difficult. It's basically like a cultural barrier, and it's difficult to educate people to the differences that exist. And I mentioned earlier just the difference between the reserve side and the active side. And you have the same thing between branches of the military. When I was in Okinawa, back to my Air Force career, I spent 3 years in Okinawa in a unit. That's where we went through the KAL shoot down and all that stuff. We would have friction between Air Force guys and Marines, and there wasn't a very large Army presence on Okinawa, but a lot of the Marines would come down if they had base Liberty, and they'd come down to the Air Force base because it was a lot nicer. Well, some of our guys were kind of, frankly, they were stupid. It was like, you're Air Force guys. We take care of technical stuff. Well, if they went into the enlisted club and they're drinking a little bit, and some Marine would go in there and make fun of the Air Force, and they'd get in a fight and they'd get their clocks cleaned because he's trained to fight and we're not. And I'd say, you know, I'd tell my friends, I'd say, man, you should be buying him a beer and thank him that he does what he does. And he would probably be bored out of his mind doing what we do. So I think the big problem is just people don't understand what other people are going through. So if I hear negative comments about the military, I just ask the person, well, why do you think that? And then I just mention some of my experience. And, yeah, if they've got a loved one who's been through a really negative thing, I know people in the Air Force who did very dangerous jobs, so not everything in the Air Force is cushy. My experience on my 2 deployments with the Army National Guard, you know, we had a few mortar rounds come in or rockets or something on the base, but my primary job wasn't to be a trigger puller. So just because somebody has been in a particular branch or even to a particular location, my son's experience, his second deployment to Iraq when he was active duty, totally different from when he and I had been over there together with the National Guard. He went back in 2008. He was in Baghdad, and it was very, he said, wow, I'm in a really kind of an upscale middle-class neighborhood, and the women dress Western, and they like us being here because it provides them security. And I think at that point in the mission, I think Petraeus was the guy in charge over there at the time, and he started the whole idea of combat outposts because, yeah, when we were there in 05, we kind of were huddled in on this base, and we didn't interact much with the locals. And so they could have crazy things like firefights between the police and the Army. Well, by the time my son went back in 08, they had put smaller elements of the U.S. military out into neighborhoods and in smaller areas, and then the locals would feel pretty safe, like, okay, the Americans will help us if we have trouble. And so it was actually very effective. And so my son's experience was quite different in a 3-year span and being in a different geographical location. So that can make a lot of difference as well.
So, I mean, you've had a really long career with the military, obviously. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's it like being out now? Do you ever consider going back in?
I'll be honest. There's days I miss some of the things I used to do, but then there's other days that I'm – it's like when I got called from my – kind of my chain of command before my retirement. They're like, well, do you want to go for 24 years? And I'm like, no, I just want to get out. But that was because my particular job was very stressful. I used to think recruiting was the most stressful thing I had ever done. But trying to be in a one-man unit in a remote place like Hamilton and have everything ready to go for a deployment, that was pretty stressful. I used to joke, yeah, you do an 07's job for E6 pay because you're supposed to make your commander successful. You have to make the platoon sergeant successful. And they're usually just part-time people. And they can be very smart, but it's just a part-time thing for them. And so you're under a lot of pressure to have everything ready to go. So, yeah, there's times if I could go back part-time, I think I would enjoy it. And I did enjoy it when I was part-time because it was like one weekend a month I got to go. You know, if I was with the infantry, we would kind of go camping in the woods and you get to play war games. And it's a lot of fun for a lot of younger guys in particular, and I always enjoyed it. And but then there were those people that, boy, once they get called up to go, they were – it was kind of disappointing because there are people who will try to get out of it at any cost, you know, like, oh, well, now my knee bothers me. And So it's just, again, it just depends on how people react to stress. But I miss it sometimes, but there's part of me that I'm glad it's over with too. So,
I mean, so the highest E6 is a sergeant, right?
Yeah, in the Army it would be a staff sergeant. In the Air Force it would be a tech sergeant. And then in the Marines I think it's a staff sergeant as well. The names change, but
yeah. I mean, so do you ever wish you would have attained a higher rank?
You know, if I had known early on in my career what I found out later, I probably should have gone to OCS. And because frankly, what an O3, you know, a captain, an officer who's only been promoted twice, makes a lot more than a guy who's been promoted six or seven times on the enlisted side. But it's kind of like that movie, The Butterfly Effect. You can't go back and just change one thing, because if I had gone through Officer Training Corps and finished my degree, that was actually the main reason why I didn't do it. I didn't have the money at that time to be able to go back to college and finish my last 2 years. And that just was an accident of timing. When I was in the Air Force, they didn't have the GI Bill. They hadn't started the new Montgomery GI Bill. And so the program I had to try to save money for school with was the old VEEP program. So the only way I got money for school is I had to contribute $1 and the government would match with $2. And through personal circumstances, I pulled a lot of money out of that to use for a family emergency. And so I only had $750 toward college when I got out of the Air Force. And that was nobody's fault. It was just the way it went. Now, when I did get to go to Iraq and then again to Afghanistan, since I spent over 90 days in theater, what I'm using now for school is that new post 9/11 GI Bill, which my oldest daughter, when she was in the Air Force, had not contributed. And when she got out, had no money for school. She'd been going through school on her own expense for a while. And then she called me one day and says, "Dad, we can get the post 9/11. I'm like, "No." And she says, "No, check it out." And she was right. So she was able to finish her degree, and I was able, and I'm almost done with mine. So, yeah, they're good benefits. And I guess the thing I think would be valuable is if all young people had an opportunity of some sort to go overseas and live in a different culture and be exposed to different kinds of people. And even if you couldn't go overseas, if just most civilians had an opportunity to see how the military works, at least at some level. And again, all those branches are going to be different. The Air Force is different than the Army, and they're both different than the Marine Corps. So I think we're just, at some point, we're going to just be limited by our human experience and what we can get crammed into a lifetime. So, but.
Is there anything else you want to tell me about your military experience?
No, I think that's it. I'm sorry I talked so long.
No, it's fine.
All right.
Well, I think we're